Support for Looking Up comes from Cincinnati Museum Center, presenting Destination Moon, the Apollo 11 mission. You can see more than 20 objects flown aboard the historic Apollo 11 mission, plus the command module Columbia, the only portion of the historic spacecraft to survive the lunar journey. Open now at Cincinnati Museum Center.
Hey, Anna, we've got this really cool thing we just got recently, a 3D printed version of a comet nucleus. Are you? Is that,
you and I have different definitions of cool.
It is very cool.
Just
so,
hit
like,
me.
You can get like the schematics the of every of any object and put it onto a computer and it can 3D print it.
That's cool.
So, like, if there's a a planet or a comet or part of a spacecraft or
you just 3D print that bad boy.
Yeah. Was there some? It sounded like something.
I was thinking
to
like
that you would want.
My face, like a bust that I could display around my house of just my head.
At your house.
Well, or as a gift to a friend.
No, I like it at the house better than in a public place, I would think, because.
You're off printing comet nuclei.
Yeah.
Nuclei?
Yeah.
Nucleus?
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
So, what scale, though? Don't you have to like. Make sure it's, I mean, how do you?
Yeah,
sure?
It can't be full size, that's for sure. So that'd be
okay,
a lot.
To be fair, that's not what I was asking.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I'm not an astronomer, but I know that it's probably not going to be to scale,
right,
to size.
Right.
That's fun, though.
But yeah, and you can make like a Apollo 11 rocket. You can make a.
It's kind of fun.
Yeah. So it's pretty amazing the what you can do with this kind of stuff. And so we like showing that off at the observatory.
Yeah, those are fun.
They think it's pretty cool, at least.
Oh, yeah.
Not as good as your head.
Yeah, like a
bust
of myself.
At the observatory. That would be
under like I think a glass, like where you like like a box,
right?
Like,
well, they'd have to protect it.
Absolutely,
somebody would want to steal that.
Oh, for their own personal head collection.
Those some weirdos. From the studios of Cincinnati Public Radio, I'm Dean Regas, and this is Looking Up.
And I'm Anna Heeman, and we're both from the Cincinnati Observatory. Dean's the astronomer, and questions? Oh, I've got questions. On this episode, we're talking with cartoonist, author, engineer, scientific theorist, and the creator of the webcomic XKCD, Randall Monroe. I have to say, 3D printing is really cool.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, and the fact that you can go to like a library or a makerspace, and you can literally make anything you want.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's crazy.
Yeah, I mean, like, if you wanted to get special parts made for things, like, I'm actually thinking that if we really needed to, we could get parts made for telescopes,
Really?
So you could, like, put a telescope together by 3D printed. Or if you need a part that, they don't make anymore, you could get it done that way.
What is the actual material that it, you know what I mean?
Yeah, it's this kind of, like,
really
plasticky stuff.
Yeah.
But that they can even make, like, things that will move and rotate and it's unbelievable.
It is. You know how I know that's true is I saw an internet video of a dachshund who needed a wheelchair and they 3D printed a piece to like fit him perfectly.
Whoa.
I know. It was the cutest little thing. He was like wheeling around. Oh my God. I think I cried.
I mean, I think that's what's so good about this age is like you can find the answer to anything. You could find ways that, anybody's ideas of how they do it yourself it's out there. And so, like, we have this transit of Mercury where Mercury's going in front of the sun, and you got to figure out a way to make it safe to look at it because you're looking at the sun.
Yeah.
So there's this cool thing called a sun funnel that you can make with an oil funnel from AutoZone or something like that.
Okay.
You put some material on the top of it, like wax paper.
Okay.
You put it in the end of a telescope, and you can project an image of the sun, and it's totally safe. Like, it's the coolest thing to show people the sun while standing in the shade. And it's like, it kind of spread by doing it yourselfers. It's really, so we're super excited about that one.
Top of the head idea, call it a sunnel.
A sunnel? Yeah. I mean, it's
not my worst idea. It's better than a 3D bust of my head.
That, so far out of the two, that's the winner.
That is cool, though.
Yeah.
And how do you test that kind of thing, though, to make sure you don't sear your retinas?
Yes. The sunlight comes in, it spreads out. So it's like, it's not hot when it finally comes up and hits the material. And so,
it's
you're
not burning
actually
a hole through wax
right, right.
Paper.
And you don't put your face up to it. So you look at it from afar.
Yeah, who would do that?
No, no. So we have had one little issue with the sun funnel is that if the telescope is pointed slightly off from the sun, the sunlight will come in, bounce off the mirrors, and start burning the inside of the telescope.
Are you serious?
We've had it smoke once or twice, but it's real rare. It's, you know, it's rare, super rare.
Do you all like how casually he said that he almost burned a telescope from the inside out?
Yeah.
It's like, it's fine.
Yeah, but
it's no big deal.
It's a good message to the kids. Don't look at the sun or this will happen.
Or your eyes will be the inside of that telescope.
Except for like
smell smoke, you're in trouble.
And then we're like, well, but look at that of the screen on the sunnel.
I mean, just see if it. You never know. It could. You're busy. Who says two words when you could say one word?
Right. Let's keep it simple. And then the other one that's been a big hit is a do-it-yourself rocket launcher that we've made.
Oh my gosh, so fun!
And this is for water bottle rockets. So you get like a 2-liter or 1-liter, and you attach it on this launcher, and you can pump air into the water into the rocket, and you can get up to like 100, 110 psi. You release it, goes way really high. Like
some of them go really, really high.
Yeah, and it was
they say the smart water 1-liters are the best.
Yep, it seems
so.
Good
if
for
smart
you.
Water wants to sponsor us,
right,
we would be into it.
Yeah,
I think 2-liter would be hard, and that's a lot. You gotta.
It's a lot of pressure.
I mean, my arms would be. Whew, I mean, I'm ripped, but I don't know.
Yeah, but I mean, it's all done. Like we found this all online: how to make it, how to build it, and
is it a bike pump?
Yeah, and you do it by bike pump. I used to do it with a air compressor, and surprisingly, the bike pump works better.
Well, what about a compressor? I'm thinking about the things that you use to like blow up like an air mattress.
Mm-hmm.
Couldn't you
it's
do
like that?
But that's electronic. You just press a button, flip a switch. Is that a compressor?
You could do it that way. Yeah, that's a compressor.
Not the worst idea. Again, God, I'm on today.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
It's like a think tank up here.
I think so. So, like, do you have any do-it-yourself, you know, all mine are astronomy related. Do you have any
yours aren't applicable to real life.
I'll try to ask about other people's interests.
That's right. I do a lot of Googling, admittedly. Mm-hmm. Now, you have to be careful because some people have terrible ideas.
Right.
I do a lot of like household stuff. So I was like, I like a disposal issue and I wanted to like clear the disposal. And there's a way you can do it or clean it so it doesn't like smell gross. And you can do it with like vinegar and like baking soda, but you got to like time it right. Otherwise, it's like there's a little bit of sizzling that can happen. Little fizzy can go on. Now, that can be good, but then also.
Did you follow the instructions and what happened?
No, I got really bored. I was like, you had to wait like 10 minutes in between. Who's that kind of time?
Oh.
I'm somebody who has to say sunnel. I don't have the time to use sun and funnel. So, I followed it and it worked. I will say that I worry sometimes that like, is my creativity going to be stifled by being able to have access to these things? And the answer is no. I basically just have avoided burning my house to the ground.
Yeah, I think it's safe. I mean, it saves time. Yeah. It saves your creativity. Well, I mean,
you know what I mean?
You're using other people's ideas. Well, like, so I'm thinking of, you know, back in the day, we used to do telescope making at the observatory. So like the people would come over, they'd work in the basement, they'd grind their own mirrors. Like, and I started with them doing it too. And I was like, so how do we do this? And they're like, well, here's the book. You have to read the book on how to
how
make
your... How many pages was the book, roughly?
Thick. Yeah. Very thick, dusty, from the 50s. And 50s. So now...
Not much has changed.
Now, if I were to do this myself, you could find it all online really easily. And I think the only drawback was the telescope making process. There was a lot of social stuff about it. So like you're hanging out with the other people, they're all grinding their mirrors. Chatting, you know, now you just do it all at home.
Bouncing ideas off each other.
That's right. And so you could think of it that way. However, my telescope making experiment ended. I stopped making my telescope the day the observatory hired me because
you're like, see ya, sucker.
I was like, I got a bigger telescope now. But so I never finished. Nice. I never finished my telescope.
Kids, that's not the lesson here.
No, it's not a good lesson.
Not a good lesson. Do you ever Google something or like look out something online that you want to do and you don't see any instructions? Like it's not a thing.
Yeah. Oh.
And then you're like, oh man,
you
what
just
have
created?
I
created? You invented something?
Well, like. Am I the only person? I just think, like, I find comfort. And if I'm looking for something, I'm trying to figure out a process or how to fix something or whatever. It's like, what if no one else has done that? Then I'm like, oh, man.
You're an inventor. You need to go on that invention website. And
I'm an innovator.
Or go to Shark Tank or something.
Right. Well, I don't know about that. Maybe it's just, don't do it. is the other thing. Oh, like, it's like,
I didn't think of that.
Like, maybe don't fill a 2-liter with water and then shoot in the sky. But I mean, not in your case. It's fine because the kids love it.
Well, it seems to work.
No, I think it's great. Super safe.
We did break that one window.
We broke that one.
Just one window.
We did have to send our coworker out to the small porthole window to get one off the roof too, more than one time.
Yeah, that's minor, fine. It's minor things.
No, it's
nobody
totally
was injured.
Safe. Yeah, no, I think it was great. She loved it.
Yeah, but I think we're gonna learn some tips from our guest here coming up that might keep us safe.
Yeah, that's important. Safety first.
Well, we are very excited to have in the studio Randall Monroe. He has a degree in physics. He worked for NASA during and after college at the Langley Research Center, and then he left it all behind to become a webcomic artist of the immensely popular XKCD. He's got a new book out called How To: Absurd Scientific Advice for Common Real-World Problems. And we're really happy to have Randall in the studio with us. Thanks for stopping by.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, so I've got to ask about your background in your science background and working for NASA. We've talked to a lot of people who work for NASA, and we just hear some pretty interesting stories. What was that like starting off?
It was really, really cool. I started off as an intern working on a project. They had a student internship program at NASA Langley Research Center, and I worked on 3D visualization stuff. You get inside a bunch of screens with goggles and see Mars in 3D around you. And then someone who I met there the next year hired me to work as a contractor in their robotics lab. And so then the next year for 2006, I worked on robot navigation in a lab in a building across the center.
And the 3D simulation, is that anything like the holodeck on Star Trek?
A little bit. It's
really?
Something that, well, by you're that. Not expecting that,
I was
were you?
Expecting
you're
that.
Like, what?
I mean, it's more like the holodeck than any other part of Star Trek. Yeah, no, it's actually something that I feel like is now less impressive because of there are all those like Oculus type glasses, but it was trying to find a cheap way to do that was portable without strapping computers to your head.
That does sound like the holodeck.
It does. Oh, yeah, exactly like it.
Yeah, you stood in the middle of like a square of screens, you know, cube of screens that were back projected onto, and then and you wore shutter glasses that synced up. So all of them were 3D, but they all meshed together. So
That sounds pretty cool.
Yeah,
that sounds cool. So, kind of curious, what made you shift into more of this? Of course, like, you know, being an author and an artist, and how did that kind of come about?
A big part of it was just a lot of things lined up at the right time. Mm-hmm. I had always been doodling in my notebooks and would draw a lot in class, you know, both idly doodling while I'm paying attention and intently doodling, not paying attention at all. and at some point I started putting some of those onto my website that I had, but just to kind of share them with friends. And then when I worked, when I was working at NASA, people also started sharing the drawings around more, and then were asking for, you know, hey, can I get a T-shirt of this, or can you make a print of this that I can buy? I'll pay you for it. And I was like, oh, cool, you know, this is really exciting. And so there was one point where like my sale, I put up a web store, and it started, you know, I started making money from that. But then right at the same time, the contract I was working on ran out and they decided not to renew it. And they were going to offer me another contract, you know, but I had to do some work to go get it. And so it was almost like a path of least resistance. I was really, like I said, well, I have some, you know, I'm making a little bit of a living right now on this web thing, and it seems to be like picking up. Mm-hmm. So I think I can afford to, you know, take a break for a little bit, you know, to try doing this. Because like, I don't know, they both felt so exciting. But I didn't feel quite like I was closing either door. Cause I, you know, they had given me the numbers like, here, if you want to get a new you want to work on a new project, just call this number. And I said, okay, well, I can always, you know, go call that number, and then just never did.
Well, so one day I came in to work at the observatory, and one of your earlier books was on my desk, is the Thing Explainer, which is like this great detailed book of all these. Well, I guess the title says it all. So there's that book, and your earlier book was What If? Is that the one that came first before the Thing Explainer?
And yep, so, What If, and then Thing Explainer.
So how did those come about?
Well, I found that when I did comics about these scientific topics, you know, I would just be doing drawing comics about whatever it was I was thinking about at the time or working on at the time, and I found that sort of to my surprise, people would start writing letters to me asking me to settle disputes that they had with their friends that were sort of like scientific disputes, but there was a little bit of a subtext to it, like, this doesn't seem like a good enough problem to bother a real scientist with, but we all agreed you seemed like a good person to ask.
So it's like a bar bet, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And they were like, we've been arguing over this, and we agreed that, like, you seemed like maybe you'd be a good, like, we agreed that whatever you said, that we'd accept that as the answer.
Wow, that's a very prestigious position.
That is. Yeah, yeah.
But then occasionally
that.
They would say, like, this seemed too ridiculous to bother someone who had something better to do.
Oh, you know, like, all right, yeah.
So it's a little... But I had so much fun researching the questions, because, like, once you... If you hear a question and you sort of think you know a way to answer it, but you're not sure... Like, for me, it's always... It's like getting a song stuck in your head where you... It's like I'll drop whatever I'm doing, even if it's something important, because I'm, like, suddenly caught up in trying to figure out the answer to this question. And so I would end up, like... I would get a message on like AOL Instant Messenger or something, you know, whatever we were on at that point, and then spend like 6 hours researching. Before I knew it, I'd been like disappeared down a bunch of Wikipedia rabbit holes and a bunch of scientific papers and a bunch of, you know, all over the place. And then I had this whole like carefully researched answer and could send it back. And then half the time I would just get like, oh, cool. So, you know, like Sarah was right. Great. You know, and I would be like, oh, okay. But then I felt like, hey, wait, I'm having a lot of fun doing these. And also, maybe I should not just send them to one person where, for all I know, the email is just going to bounce anyway. Like, maybe other people would want to read these. And so I started posting those on my website and soliciting more questions. And boy, did people have a lot of questions. Mm-hmm. And so I just had so much fun answering those that I ended up doing the book What If out of them.
That's really cool. And then, so I believe for your latest book, you interviewed a lot of experts and you talked to a lot of folks.
Yeah, well, I've tended to do mostly like solo research, mm-hmm. and I'm always really reluctant to call anyone on the phone right. or like bother anyone, you know. So I'll spend, you know, most of the time I try to see if I can like part of the fun of it is like, can I figure out a way to answer this question using what I already know?
Okay.
And so for What If, there were one or two places where I've contacted experts to get help with something or, you know, especially fact-checking. With How To, I did that more. It's still, you know, only I'd say a handful of the chapters. But there were a few places where I realized, you know what would be really great here is talking to an expert who knows how to do this thing. Mm-hmm. And then try to throw all kinds of questions that I've always had at them to see how they would approach it.
And how did that go?
I was really surprised, first of all, by how enthusiastic everyone was about helping. Like,
that's nice.
Yeah, I guess maybe like the people who sent their questions to me, I was assuming that, oh, these people all have something better to do. They're all going to be busy. But people seemed excited to have something to work on that wasn't, you know, I guess the kind of question they usually get. I think my single favorite chapter in the book is where I interviewed astronaut Chris Hadfield. Mm-hmm. I had a chapter on how to make an emergency landing, mm-hmm. and he's an astronaut, commander of the International Space Station, and a test pilot who's flown like over 100 different aircraft. And so I got a list of all the most ridiculous situations in which you might need to land a plane and got him on the phone, and I got to just ask him what he would do in each one.
I liked the ski jump one.
How to land on a ski jump.
I was like, is this a real problem?
Well, I was surprised by which ones... So I was, first of all, surprised because I was going to start with my least ridiculous one and work my way up.
Oh, that's forgettable.
And then I was expecting at some point he would hang up on me.
You'd be like, that was the breaking point. Yeah. That was the one he thought
so
was
like,
too much.
I wanted to get as many answers as I could before that happened.
That's smart.
But then to my surprise, he just answered every question I asked with no pause, no hesitation,
that's
no delay.
Awesome.
And I mean, I guess it makes sense that trying to stump a test pilot by throwing surprising situations at them might not go the way I expected. But yeah, I was surprised though. Some of the ones I asked him about, like landing on a ski jump, and he said that he didn't think that the odds of success would be good. He didn't think you could do that. You know, you have the problem of the where the stands are located. It turned out he was a ski instructor before he was a pilot.
Oh my gosh.
He does everything. Really? But then he said, you know, so you could do it this way, but you'd have to get the timing just right. I wouldn't like the odds of that. And you'd only get one shot at it. If you're too early or too late, you wouldn't get a second try. Mm. But then I asked him, okay, well, what about landing on top of a train? You know, can you match speed with the train and lower yourself down onto it, you know, just gently? And he said, oh, sure, people have done that.
Oh, yeah, that's no big deal.
He's like, I did that last week. What, like, are you talking about?
He's like, flatbed trucks, too. You see that at air shows sometimes.
Wow.
Yeah.
I would not have.
I thought that'd be the harder one of the two.
Yeah, especially moving.
So that was what was really cool, was hearing from someone, like, sometimes the answer would be like, no, that's hard for a reason I hadn't thought about, you know? Or it would be like, not only is that easy, but yeah, I've done that.
Oh, my gosh.
Well, I did. I'm glad you mentioned that chapter, because your drawings of people are, you know, they're minimalist, but your drawing of astronaut Hadfield is dead on. I mean, it's like a stick figure with a mustache. That's Chris Hadfield.
Yeah,
like, I flipped to that page. I was like, yep, there's Chris Hadfield. So well done with that.
Oh,
that
thank you. Yeah, it's fun to try to like, I have like three lines to work with. How can I make it look as much like that person as possible?
The book, the how-to, it does start with a disclaimer of a do not try this at home, which is kind of weird, isn't it? Like, how to do something, but then don't exactly do this. Are you daring people, I guess? That's what you're...
Because Dean will not back down dare him to do one of these crazy...
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, don't do these crazy things.
Change a light bulb with drones, you know, dare me, I'll do it. But
what's fun about these is I'm trying to think of ways that you might try to do something and then work through what would happen if you did. And a lot of the time, you know, I can have a disclaimer in the front, but I feel like the instructions themselves are almost more of a warning away from doing something. Like, there's a chapter on how to ski, which... I wrote, despite having still never put on a pair of skis in my life.
Oh, boy.
So this is like ideas on how to ski from someone who has never skied. And it involves liquid oxygen and like a lot more explosions and fire than you would normally see. So like there's a, you know, I feel like if you just flip through the diagrams in the how to ski chapter, that'll put you off following any of those instructions more than the disclaimer would.
I see. That's a good way to protect that.
I feel like the wheels are turning, Dean. He said don't do these things.
Explosions and skiing. I like the
I thought
like that
skiing
combo.
Is a very calming. Now all of a sudden I'm thinking of explosions.
No, wait. I feel like neither of you have the right idea here, because I feel like, wait, skiing, that it seems intense. It doesn't usually involve fire, but
that's I'm like,
I'm
like
a little nervous
slopes.
About trying regular skiing.
Yeah, that's fair. I was thinking more like tubing.
Oh yeah,
you know, that's minimal risk.
Right. Sledding, yeah.
Minimal explosions.
Yeah,
I'm on board with this explosions thing. So wherever the ski slope is that exists, I'm on board.
Look, any ski slope can be a ski slope with explosions if you just dream.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. In my mind, oh my yes. Gosh. Yeah, when I'm going down the slope, I'm just picturing.
Yeah, just. Like an action movie.
Yeah. Well, Randall, thanks so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun talking about your books, and we really appreciate you spending the time with us.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
We've been talking with physicist turned comic strip and book author Randall Monroe.
Well, so many kid questions, and fortunately, we have hopefully time for some answers here.
Okay.
We love hearing from kids of all ages. Questions about the universe, etc. Here's a question we received recently. Are you ready?
Ready.
Okay. How would you survive on other planets?
Ooh.
I mean, Mars is maybe going to be a thing.
Mars, Mercury. Well, that's good. So we got
Neptune. I don't feel like Neptune doesn't get talked about enough.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't. Neptune's
it's
kind of out
there.
So we're going to talk about the 8 planets. Just the 8?
No.
We limiting to. All right. Well, let's go one by one.
Totally forgot one.
Oh, I did. No, I think I didn't. I think I counted them all. I'll do it again. 1, 2, 3.
I can't work
8.
Like
there's
this.
There's only 8. That's all we got. So, we were going to go to each planet, and so this is what's kind of I say this jokingly, but it's painfully real. Like, I don't think we appreciate Earth well enough.
Yeah.
Like, we all talk about, let's go to other planets, let's colonize other planets. These other planets will be our safety valve, like in case the Earth blows up. We want to be able to survive.
Well, maybe don't ruin Earth and we don't have to go somewhere else.
Yeah. Right. There is no other place anywhere in the whole universe we have found where you can walk outside and not die. Like, there's no place.
But we haven't surveyed the whole universe yet.
Yeah,
but
nothing that we've seen is, you know, the worst place on Earth, the worst possible place you could be on Earth is better than the best place on Mars.
Okay, like, I could see that.
So if you wanted to survive...
Sorry, Mars.
Sorry, Mars. So if you wanted to survive on Mercury, for instance, Mercury's bad, bad place to go. I mean, it's a rocky planet close to the sun, so it's very hot when it's daytime. So about 800 degrees Fahrenheit when it's daytime, 200 below zero when it's nighttime. So it's a 1,000-degree swing in temperature.
Bring a parka and a tank top.
Bring a lot. Bring a swimming pool. That'll evaporate in no time. But my idea was that you need to like stand where the dark meets the light, you know, stand right at sunset and just like keep rotating like a rotisserie or something it'd be hard to follow, but you could probably figure it out.
Yeah, it's totally fine.
But then you got then you got the radiation. So you're like, it's basically like living inside of a microwave. Mercury is pretty much out.
Okay.
Venus, even worse. Venus is a place that's 900 degrees on the planet.
So we're up 100 degrees.
Up 100 degrees.
It's only getting worse.
And it never goes below 900 degrees. Oh. It's 900 all the time.
That's a deal breaker for me. I like a chill.
Yep. So you would probably, if you wanted to live near Mars or near Venus, you'd have to be up in the clouds about 50 miles up. So it'd be, think of Cloud City, Star Wars. I hate to mention Star Wars, but it always comes back to Star Wars. Mars then would be the best of the planets to live on because the temperature range isn't so bad.
Okay.
It still gets very, very cold, close to about 180 below zero at night, but it could get up to about 50 or 60 on a hot summer day.
Okay. Actually, it's not like my ideal temperature.
It's not bad. It's not bad. But that's a pretty outlier. It's mostly in the 20 below zero range or something like that. But no oxygen, very little water. You have to bring everything with you. But that's the best case scenario. All the other planets,
Neptune included.
Neptune, Uranus, Jupiter, Saturn. There is no place. There's no solid even surface for you to stand on. So it's all gases. So if you go to any of those planets and you plant your flag, you will sink into the planet with the flag. You're like, I colonized this for the United States. And then you're down through there. Yeah.
Bummer.
It's hard. You can't build a house there. That's for sure.
That's right. I'll just stay here.
So if you were really looking for places, yeah, Mars is tops. But you also could look at the moons, various moons of the planets, the moon Europa around Jupiter is a nice spot. The moon Enceladus around Saturn and Titan around Saturn. So there's lots of moons. And then, of course, there's the dwarf planets, Pluto and all the others. Then you don't want to go to those.
I do want to go to those.
Pluto would be an interesting one because it does have seasons. It does have a little bit of atmosphere.
It kills you to admit this, doesn't it?
It has a lot of ice.
So I love ice. I love ice skating. I love ice cream. I love ice.
Those are the two. That's pretty good. they have one of them. They have the ice part. The ice cream you got to bring yourself.
Anyway.
But
fine.
It is an interesting dynamic world. Even though it's, you know, 3 billion miles from the sun, it still is a very kind of active place. Not a good place to go live, though. Well, first of all, the commute would be far. It'd take about 9.5 years to get there. So
okay, well,
And then yeah, coming back by the time you get home, it would be a little late, I think. So
fine.
But it's definitely an interesting place to go. Then you've got asteroids you could go visit. But again, it always goes back to Earth is still the place.
We're number one.
We got to, So thanks for the question. How do you survive on other planets?
You don't.
Thank you.
Sorry. Well, that's it for this episode of Looking Up. A big thanks to Randall Monroe for joining us. You'll find a link to Randall on our website, wvxu.org/lookingup.
If you're new to Looking Up, welcome. You've missed a lot of great conversations. Find the archives of all of our past episodes at wvxu.org/lookingup.
We love talking with guests like Randall Monroe. If there's someone from the space and astronomy world, or maybe someplace we've not thought of that you'd like to hear on Looking Up, let us know. Our email is lookingup@wvxu.org.
You can subscribe to Looking Up wherever you listen to podcasts. And please give us a rating and comment on Apple Podcasts. Those are incredibly helpful and we really appreciate it.
Our theme song and additional music is by Y, that's W-H-Y question mark, from their album Moline, courtesy of Joyful Noise Recordings and Terror Bird Media.
Looking Up is a production of Cincinnati Public Radio. Kevin Reynolds is our producer, Josh Elstro is our engineer, and Jim Nolan provides additional technical assistance.
Thanks so much for listening. I'm Anna Heeman.
And I'm Dean Regas. Keep looking up.